Do you have a dark curiosity? Heart Starts Pounding, Horrors, Hauntings, and Mysteries is a weekly podcast hosted by me, Kaylin Moore. Each week, I'll take you on a dark journey through terrifying true urban legends, bizarre true crime cases, chilling tales of backwoods horror, and more. So if you're looking to join a passionate community of the darkly curious, check out Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, stay curious.
A lot of baseball, Mets, Yankees, that's on the board early on in the program. Out to Stratford, Connecticut we go, kicking off the 11 o'clock hour. It's Richard, it's the fan. What's going on, Richard?
Moose, I got to tell you how much I love listening when you're on. I wish you were on more often.
I appreciate that, Richard. Thank you, brother.
I got two quick things to run by you. Number one, I think that Aaron Boone's problem with the public is because you just don't understand how he comes up with these things. For example, everybody's talking about whether he's holding the team responsible for their errors and their bad base running. And yet he talks about Volpe like he's the future. We don't know that. I do not understand why he's in the lineup all the time. He just had 2 days off, and he proceeded to go 0-for-8. I think that if he said, you know what, we're going to – I can't remember the other gentleman's name they got in the trade. He should be your shortstop right now if you want in the last 29 games.
Yeah, Caballero.
That's number one. I mean, I just don't understand that, and I think that's what leads to people not believing that Boone is doing what he thinks he's doing or says he's doing. And number two, last year I think we made a mistake. Maybe it came out and I didn't hear about it. But with Soto, if they had offered him 15 years at $40 million, I don't think he would have gone and taken a chance that he was going to make that much more money. I think we're making the same mistake now oh my goodness, I can't think of his name.
Bellinger,
the outfield.
What are you talking about?
Bellinger.
Okay.
They should offer him a contract now. He is a complete baseball player. I love to watch him play.
Yeah, I think Bellinger loves. Yeah, Richard, I appreciate the call and thanks for the compliment. Let's start with at the beginning with Volpe and the Yankees. I think the Yankees are, unfortunately, they're in the foxhole. We've seen it with other players. You saw it with Gary Sanchez, you've seen it, and I'm not saying that's where Anthony Volpe's career is going to go, but I think we could all look at Volpe in terms of his greatest asset was going to be what he was going to provide offensively, and whatever he was defensively, his offense was going to be able to make up for it. You know, there was a number of years ago, the Yankees didn't enter the great free agency shortstop class that offseason because, you know, they had the next Derek Jeter within the organization, so they thought, in Anthony Volpe. And this is not kind of being, you know, hypersensitive to him or being overcritical, I should say, the right words, overcritical of Anthony Volpe. But that's basically what he was described as. And he's not. I mean, let's be realistic. He's not. You know, the baseball IQ is not, the offensive, you know, prowess is not, even what, you know, Jeter, who had a penchant for making the big moment, always making seemingly to make the right defensive play, even though people over the years when Derek Jeter was manning shortstop would always be super critical of what he was as a defensive player at shortstop. You know, he wasn't what Jeter is, even though Volpe has won a gold glove. Great. I mean, that does nothing for me when you look at where the player is. The issue with Volpe is he's become almost a poster child of really the current regime of the Yankees and how they look at baseball, because the Yankees want to tell you stuff and want to tell you stuff about players that just is not true. Like, they continue to want to tell you, like, when Brian Cashman went off the deep end a couple GM meetings ago out in Arizona and was holding everybody accountable and, you know, was hypersensitive to the people talking about the Yankees analytics department being the biggest amount of all of Major League Baseball and said, I'll be taking apologies when Volpe's going out there hitting 320 and, you know, all this stuff that we have seen, right? The question I have for you is Volpe getting better or is he getting worse? Like, players evolve, players change. You know, is he getting better or is he getting worse? And as a young player, it's one thing to make the major leagues, but you have to continue to evolve. You got to go out there and continue to get better. And the best version of yourself usually isn't in the first couple years of Major League Baseball. If you're really, really good and cement yourself as a starter slash all-star slash great player, foundational piece of that organization, you get better and better as the years go along. Do you get better, or does, you know, or is he rotting away on the vine? And we've seen a number of players, you know, outside Aaron Judge. I mean, we've seen them. You can run down the litany of them. Guys like Clint Frazier is now doing a podcast and ripping the Yankees left and right. But very, very entertaining. And I don't have a thick, I don't have a thin skin when it comes to the Yankees, but it's still, it's very entertaining. You got Clint Frazier doing it. Miguel Andujar, Greg Bird with his ankle injuries. And he was getting called out of that by his toughness, by those within the Yankee organization. Remember that a number of years ago, Fall League MVP. One point in time, Cashman thought he was the best hitter within the organization. Minor leagues or Major leagues. You look at Volpe. You look at what Jason Dominguez. I mean, there were Yankee fans out there running around about the Martian and, you know, what he was going to be because of that, like, 10-game stretch before he suffered the UCL injury in an 82-80 loss season that all of a sudden the Yankees have found themselves their next Mickey Mantle. Well, I mean, he's not that. And he also can't field, which is an issue. So when you look at Volpe and you look at the Yankees, if you're going to say to yourself, well, who gives us the best opportunity to win? If ultimately the guidance is, you know, I'm going to put my best team out there because those players give me the best opportunity to win day in and day out. Well, if you're going to do that, instead of kind of being thick-headed, instead of going out there and being like in that foxhole with the player and saying, you know what, we're going to prove everybody wrong, then Anthony Volpe has not earned it. Not this year. And you're not getting the best version of Anthony Volpe, despite what the Yankees want to tell you. When you rationalize it, well, I didn't love him throwing to second base, but still I understand why he did. No, it's a bad baseball play. Or when Volpe up in Toronto is making bad baseball, bad decisions in the field, the throw to third, the throw to first base, which allowed a base runner to go out there and take an extra base. And you're saying to yourself, what is he doing? And after the game, he's like, well, we're taught to be aggressive here with the Yankees. Well, no, that's bad baseball. Like, it's really not that difficult. Like, that's bad baseball. You don't do it. Kids in Little League are taught that way. So that's it. When it comes to Bellinger, listen, I wouldn't draw a comparison between Bellinger and Soto. I said at the time, when I walked out of Yankee Stadium, you know, and it was like 2 in the morning, I think it was, after Soto met with the media for 45 minutes, after the Yankees, you know, went into the Dodgers clubhouse, watching everybody shower themselves with champagne, celebrating winning World Series, Ohtani, shirtless, all this stuff, and everything like that. And they, to the victor go the spoils, right? You know, and then, you know, into the Yankee clubhouse, into the doldrums, and you see, you know, Judge meeting with the media, and Stanton meet with the media, and Volpe, and all these guys, and then you're waiting for Soto. As I walked out of that building that night, after listening to Soto address the media for 45 minutes, I said at the time on social media, I said it on WPIX, I said it here on WFAN, like, he was going to the highest bidder. There was no offer the Yankees were going to make next last year that was going to prevent him from going out there and hitting free agency because he was that close to it. And then once he hit free agency and the Yankees entered in, and this is kind of walking down the path we've already walked down, the Yankees entered into a period where they were never going to, as long as there was no emotional draw to the Yankees, they entered a bidding process that they were never going to be the highest bidder. And if being making the most amount of money, which I don't fault them for, was the ultimate goal, the Yankees were never going to be the highest bid. John and Bayonne's up next in the Fan. What's going on, John?
Hey, Moose, Monsignor. I missed you Sunday, but Father Jerry filled in well for you, very well. Had a good
time. Yeah, I took my youngest son, Gregory, up to Saratoga for the Travers. We had a great time. We got a number of pictures with jockeys. Got a great picture with Junior Alvarado after the Travers victory for Sovereignty. So had a great time up there. So I was off on Sunday. I'll be back this Sunday, and football Sunday's right around the corner. But I appreciate it. Yeah, Jerry's great. Love him.
Well, it's funny you say about jockeys, but I'm small. My father wanted me to be a jockey. I said, no, that horse is too big for me, you know?
I mean, they're amazing athletes. John, they're amazing athletes. The thing about, you know, to have the power, to be the size, have the control, to be going the speed that they go, it's really remarkable to watch. But what else you got, Johnny?
Well, I look at, you know, this beating up on the bad teams, okay? I'd be more upset if they were losing to the bad teams. Okay,
that's fair.
That's what I would do. Yeah, you know. But as it comes down to it, though, we just got to hope and do like we did last year and hope that we don't get stuck playing the Boston or something like that, and the bad teams beat them and we beat them. If not, that's baseball. You know, I mean, as far as anything, you can't change the game, you know, because, you know, bad teams are bad teams, and you know what, they're going to give them a couple runs advantage, you know. So I'm not upset over the Yankees beating on the bad teams. I'm more upset if they would lose to the bad teams, you know.
No, see, there's a difference between being upset and I didn't come on the airwaves upset. I drew a comparison between the Mets and the Yankees in terms of a fear factor. I think there is a fear amongst National League teams, given the fact of how good the Mets closed out last year, about them finding it. And there were massive issues, and the Mets were desperate, and they went to their farm system. Nolan McClain's been brilliant in three starts. We'll see what Jonah Tong is on Friday night against the Miami Marlins. They're starting to hit with runners in scoring position. Bottom third of the lineup, Vientos has all of a sudden found himself, has got that 10-game hitting streak. You like to see that if you're a New York Met fan. To go along with the cavalcade of stars that they have in that lineup, Alonso with a huge bounce-back season, and he's going to opt out after this year and see exactly what the free agency waters looks like this upcoming offseason after it being as tepid as it was this past offseason. So, but there's a lot of excitement around the Mets, given what they've, you know, the fact that their belief is that they've turned a corner. Now, you can look at the Yankees and you can say, well, the Yankees have as well. Look at what they've done the last 15 games. Look at, you know, the power. Look at the offense. Look at them going out there and embarrassing teams. My only thing is, I don't think the upper echelon teams in the American League fear the Yankees. I know they don't. They don't look at the Yankees like they once did. Now, you might say, well, that's more narrative than it is reality. That's fair. You can look at it that way and say that's, you know, but on the field, when we look at the Yankee performance, I've not seen this team play championship caliber baseball consistently. I've seen small stretches. I've not seen it consistently enough to think that they'll be able to get through what is really a wide open and very, very winnable American League. But, well, you know, there are positives. You look at Bellinger, Grisham, Fried last two starts. Schlittler's been really good. Will Warren, back end of the bullpen, still needs a little bit of work. You still hold your breath at times with the back end of that bullpen. But I look at this Yankee team this year. It's been fun to watch. They're more of a bully team than anything else. But I don't think anything differently about the Yankees. You learned a little something last three games for the Mets against the Phillies. You didn't really learn anything last three games against the Nats.
Yeah, well, you look at it with the jinx that, oh, the way they play Philly and City Field, they lost the last 10. So, you know, they could have a little monkey in the back like the Yankees have with this year with the Red Sox and Toronto, you know?
Well, that's fair. And I don't think there's any doubt. I think the Philly.
Some crimes are so shocking, they don't just make headlines, they forever change our society. I'm Katie Ring, host of America's Most Infamous Crimes. Each week, I take on one of the most notorious criminal cases. Each case unfolds across multiple episodes, released every Tuesday through Thursday, from the first sign that something was wrong to the moment the truth came out or didn't. Listen to and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Because I think that place, that building is in them. But, to come back from 3-0 down game one, daylight that game, to answer the Harrison Bader two-run home run in game two and have four consecutive hits off Duran, and then to have the brilliant performance by Nolan McClain pitching last night, 95 pitches, 8 innings of shutout baseball, 4 hits, numerous strikeouts, and no walks. They beat them every which way they could. Frank and Syosset's up next to the fan. What's going on, Frank?
Bruce, how are you today?
How you doing, Frank?
All right, good. I guess you've seen the Stanton show on Tuesday? When they won 5-1, the Stanton show hit all 5 runs, right? Batting over 400, 20-something RBIs in August. He's amazing. But I didn't call to talk about Stan. I have a two-part question for you about Ben Rice. He seems to be a rising star. Out of the three, Dominguez, Wells, and Rice, the rising star. I mean, who knows? But I have a question for you. Where would you rather see him play permanently? How much time do we have with Goldschmidt, and what would Moose like to see the Yankees do? Keep Rice at first or behind the plate? Me personally, Moose, I'd like to see him behind the plate. I think he's got a stronger arm than Wells. He could throw guys out at second, which is important to me. You could call it old school baseball, But I like the Yankees having a catcher like Posada and all the rest of them that could throw a guy out from behind the plate. And it's
Posada, if you go back to those days as well, there were certain pitchers that didn't like throwing to Jorge Posada as well because of his pitch framing. But I was always, like you, Frank, a Posada defender during his days when he was behind home plate for the New York Yankees. Also concerns about the way he blocked home plate. I know the rules have changed in Major League Baseball. But that was some of the conversations around Jorge at the time. The rub would be is, what kind of impact am I going to have if Ben Rice is my everyday catcher, to what his real strength is, and that him being an offensive player. Like, you'd love it to be where you're going to get the similar production from him offensively. I mean, that's what makes Kyle Raleigh so special is, you know, the fact that he hits from both sides of the plate, the power, you know, going out there and hitting 50-plus home runs. But, you know, he's a day-in, day-out catcher for the Seattle Mariners. Like, that's why the Yankees were so drawn to Gary Sanchez over the years, because of that potential. Now, that potential was not realized consistently when it comes to Gary Sanchez, but that's what the Yankees wanted. They're only locked in for Goldschmidt for a year. I mean, that's it. So this season, I mean, they'll be one and done, and we'll see exactly, you know, if it's Cashman and company leading this team moving forward. You know, I think you'd look at the potential of Ben Rice being your everyday first baseman. I don't think they're ready to get off the Austin Wells train just yet as being an everyday catcher.
Really? I'm surprised, Moose, at that take. All right,
I think if you're looking at I would wanna make sure it doesn't impact his bat. I don't disagree with you. You know, he's looked better behind home plate than I really imagined he would. I want to make sure it doesn't impact what his greatest asset strength for the team is, and that is his offense. Could that change? Yeah, for sure. I mean, you could look at it. I think Wells has been more of a disappointment this year offensively, and really when the Yankees drafted him, you know, that was his greatest strength. His narrative, or the conversation around Austin Wells, there was a belief when the Yankees drafted him is that he would never be able to be an everyday catcher in Major League Baseball. Well, he has changed that. A lot of hard work. Buster's rear end has been a really good receiver behind home plate. Do I look at the Yankees saying, well, that's an avenue now for Ben Rice? I mean, potentially. I think, you know, I'm not telling you it's not out of the question, but I think probably the easier thing would be the Yankees staying firm about Wells being their catcher and having Rice play first.
Yeah, because they're saying that this talk that, you know, as Judge ages, maybe wanting to bring him into the infield. Do you think Judge could play infield? Can he play at first base?
I think Judge could play. I mean, I think Judge could play anywhere. I mean, I really do. Maybe not shortstop, maybe not third, and maybe not catch. So I should couch that a little bit, not say everywhere. But I think he's a freaky athlete. I mean, he just is. So could there be a time when, you know, he starts to slow down? Father Time catches up with all of us sometimes, some a little sooner than others. Yeah, where you can move Judge around. Yeah, for sure. But like, I think his baseball acumen is off the charts, and I think he's just an athletic freak. And you've seen that with his ability to go out there and play defense in the outfield, and especially what he was able to do when they transitioned him to center field. So could that be a possibility? Could that be on the board at some point in his career? Yeah, for sure, no doubt. Football right around the corner. Been a lot of baseball first 90 minutes. Want to touch upon a couple of things when it comes to both locals, as we've seen. You know, the roster's trimmed down to 53, and both teams are attacking the waiver wire and making some adjustments as, you know, the Jets get set to open up their season against the Pittsburgh Steelers, and the Giants get set to open up their season as just a slightly tad under a touchdown underdog on the road down in Maryland against Jaden Daniels, now with Terry McLaurin in the fold, and the Washington Commanders. Let's start with Big Blue. And listen, I was out at Giant Camp, I think it was actually 2 weeks ago today, you know, and chatted with Brian Daboll, the Joe Shane, Jackson Dart, and Javon Holland for Picks 11. And, you know, there's a little bit of a, I'll be honest with you, having, you know, been out there the last 3 or 4 years, there's a little bit of a different vibe.
Understanding power requires more than headlines. I'm Peter Hamby, host of The Powers That Be, a podcast from Puck examining politics, economics, and media to provide context, analysis, and clarity without sensationalism. We ask how power operates, who benefits, and what's at stake. If you want to move beyond breaking news to deeper understanding, join us on The Powers That Be. New episodes every weekday. Follow The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.
when you talk about the Giants this season. I think there's an excitement. You know, I think Dart provides it. I don't think there's any doubt. I think Giant fans are excited because they've got a quarterback in the fold that's looked really, really good throughout the course of the preseason. And, you know, there have been conversations about, and the Giants, here's where I give the Giants a ton of credit. They've made it perfectly clear from the night when they drafted him and moved back into the first round to go get Dart out of Ole Miss. They've made it perfectly clear that Russell Wilson is the starting quarterback. They've not backed out of it. There's been no leaks of the building. There's been no debate. There's been no open conversation. When Daboll's been asked about it, when the general manager's been asked about it, like there's been, and that's where you give the Giants credit. They've got a plan. They developed, they drafted a quarterback. They understood that he needed time to develop before he was going to be a starter in the National Football League. They haven't given you a timetable in terms of, you know, when that quarterback will start. When it comes to Jackson Dart, they haven't told you that, you know, he's going to redshirt the entire year. I mean, if Wilson plays well and the Giants are winning football games against a really difficult schedule, then, you know, you're not going to see Jackson Dart. And I think the Giants would be A-okay with that because I think they want to have a scenario here where they want to start winning some football games. I mean, that's it. You know, they want to start winning some games. You know, the idea of, you know, take another year and figure it out, or, you know, have a, you know, top 10 draft choice once again. Well, no, the Giants won. And how do you change culture? You change culture by winning. One thing, the coach can only do so much. The staff can only do so much. The GM can only do so much. You have got to get the right collection of veteran players. You've obviously got to get buy-in. You got to have the right system. All these things that come into play to winning games. But ultimately, you know, when you start to set the standard of what it is, and that is what you're judged on each and every week, 17 weeks, you know, 17 games, 18 weeks of the NFL regular season, and that is your win-loss record at the end. In the last 2 years, the Giants have lost their way. And I think when you look at this team, I think the excitement is real. First off, give Russell Wilson a ton of credit. I've never been a big, huge Russell Wilson fan. Not from, you know, in his days in Seattle, it was hard not to like. You know, the guy that was not prototypical size, had a cannon for an arm, watched him at Wisconsin, go in there, step into a role up in Seattle. Pete Carroll was the head coach. You know, they bring in a big free agent quarterback from the Green Bay Packers, and they go out there, and he beats him out for the job and is the starter his rookie year. And we saw what Russell Wilson was able to do there up in Seattle with a really good ground game and Marshawn Lynch, Legion of Boom, and everything defensively, right? Is he that quarterback now? No, I think the perception and the narrative around Russell Wilson started change after, you know, the Denver days and what was a complete and utter failure. You know, getting mocked out on social media with the Let's Ride stuff. You know, the idea of having, you know, his own personnel around the team. When Sean Payton was brought in, kind of cutting that off at the knees. You know, then, you know, it didn't work in Denver. Went to Pittsburgh for a year. Took over, looked good early, didn't look good late. But he came here with the Giants, and he has set a tone. I don't think there's any doubt about it. About, you know, what it means to be a quarterback in the NFL, the leadership. Understands that, you know, his career is not in, all in front of him. Majority of it is probably behind him. You know, it's a short-term deal. It's not a big-time commitment by the Giants, and understands that he's here to try and help the Giants win football games early, but also understands that he's not the future of this team early, you know, future of this team either. You know, and that is Dart. So, you know, give Wilson credit because I think there was a perception of Russell Wilson, especially after all the stories we heard out of Denver. And the reality with the Giants, he's been really good. I'm not talking about what he is as a performer, and we're going to judge him starting next week when they take on the Washington Commanders down in Maryland. But I'm talking about in terms of his leadership. I think the Giants have gotten everything and more that they ever could have asked for with Wilson. And that goes for a guy like Jameis Winston, too. So, you know, there's a lot to like about that quarterback room and how the Giants are developing Dart. The plan that they have, the veterans that they've put around him that have been there and done that, myriad of different success, whether it be collegiately or whether it be in the National Football League and the experience they have. I think the strength of this team, when you think about the Giants on the whole, is going to be obviously the defense and that front seven, which I think is going to have the opportunity to come at you in waves. Concern you have maybe potentially about Shane Bowen as the defensive coordinator for sure, but talent is talent. When you have Dexter Lawrence, Brian Burns, Kayvon Thibodeau, throwing Abdul Carter, obviously, the third overall pick coming out of Penn State, the remarkable depth they have, the playmakers they have on three different levels. You're throwing out Karake, hoping to bounce back after what wasn't a prototypical season a year ago. You throw in the guys like Paulson Adebo and Javon Holland. They add in the back end of that secondary, and Holland's going to be a guy that's going to be used all over the place by Shane Bowen. Defensively, I think the Giants are going to be really good. You know, what does this passing game look like? No concerns about Neighbors. He'll be ready to go week number one. He's a remarkably tough young man and is a big-time playmaker, and I think you're going to see that with Kafka and Dable and them moving him all around the field. You know, the big concern is going to be Andrew Thomas staying healthy at left tackle. You know, and that is one of those hold-your-breath kind of a deals because, you know, if he doesn't stay healthy, and he is great when he is available, but when he's not available for the Giants, that offensive line takes a massive step back. And we have spent, what is this, 2025, right? So we have spent a good 13, 14 years talking about the Giant offensive line through different head coaches, through different general managers, through different offensive line coaches, a myriad of different names that have run through it. But when you think about the Giants being a really good football team, and listen, the Giants are not winning the NFC East. You know, that's, I think, got to be realistic when you look at it. But there's a sense of hope within the building. And I think there's a sense of hope and excitement within the building. I think there's a sense of hope and excitement among the Giant fans. I think you should be. Because they're starting to develop a little bit of an identity. And when they were really good, when they were championship good, when, you know, they were winning the Super Bowls in 2007, 2011, you know, they had really good offensive line. Weren't the biggest name in the names in football, but really good offensive line. I used to do a show with David Deal week in and week out, right? He used to talk about the mantra of the NFL offensive linemen. You know, we are the reason. And there's no doubt the offensive line, they also had an identity on defense. I talked about it last year, you know, late in the year when, you know, planes were flying overhead and, you know, asking for change and Brian Daboll getting fired and Joe Shane getting fired. But I said the Giants needed to start to find an identity as an organization. And when they were really good, their offensive line was really good. But the big identity for the Giants was the defense. Growing up going to Giant games at the old Giant Stadium, you know, and seeing them take on Washington and Denver and Philadelphia and the games I was lucky enough to go to as a kid, right? And you think about Harry Carson and Carl Banks and, you know, obviously the greatest defensive player of all time and Lawrence Taylor and Gary Reasons and Pepper Johnson and Jim Burton, Leonard Marshall, I mean, George Martin. You go up and down the line, Mark Collins in that secondary. You thought about the identity of the Giants was obviously the linebackers. When you think about the championship teams in 07, 2011, Tuck, O.C. Umenyora, Michael Strahan, Matthias Kiwanuka, the ability to go out there to the NASCAR line, get after the quarterback. Well, the Giants defensively this year, no doubt, are going to have an identity. And it's going to be on defense. Now the question is, can the other phases, you know, get in lockstep to where this team takes a massive step forward in 2025? But you've got the quarterback of the future in the building, and the Giants are not going to rush it. There's excitement when you look at that defense. There's no question about it, and you should be. And I think when Joe Shane met with the media yesterday and talked about, you know, now you got to go out there. He likes the roster, but obviously the proof is going to be in the pudding in the games. There's no doubt. I think we could look back, potentially. We'll see here how this season plays out. But if everything goes right, as we took call after call after call, I think you could look back on the decision by the Giants co-owner John Mara a year ago to stay the course, and ultimately, that ends up being the right call. Let's head out to Trenton, New Jersey. It's Eric. It's the fan. What's going on, Eric?
Moose. What's going on, brother?
Eric, I'm well, man. How about yourself? Good.
I'm good. So I've heard a lot of people say that the Yankees are wasting Judge's years. And my point, my thing is that I think that they are wasting Stanton's years because he's the guy that shows up in the playoffs every year, you know, not Judge. He's been there for 7 years now, only a year less than Judge. And, you know, if his performance is what carried them, it's Judge. It's the other players that have not held their end of the bargain up. I think that Stanton's probably been one of the better Yankees over the past 7 years. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, Stanton's been great in October. There's no doubt. It's almost like they change bodies when you get to October, where you get Stanton turns into this generational player in the playoffs and kind of Judge is meek. And that's not doing Stanton credit, but you're talking about a guy that at one point in time was the MVP of the National League when he was with the Marlins. So, exactly. You know, got paid a ton of money. The Yankees, you know, Marlins didn't want to pay it. They got him for set, you know, pennies on the dollar in that trade with Miami and brought him here. Yeah. Like I've mentioned before, my appreciation for Giancarlo Stanton has grown over the years. From, you know, when we got into him getting booed at Yankee Stadium, all the conversations we've had on this very radio station, he's handled it very, very classy. There's been no thumbs down. There's no been taking on the fans. There's been none of that. You know, he's taken it all in stride. I think what Boone talks about now with Giancarlo Stanton is true. I think he wants to win. You know, I do. And I think you're seeing the best version of Giancarlo Stanton. So you can look at it. The difference is that Judge is, you know, a generational regular season player from what he's been able to accomplish. The combination of power and speed is remarkable. He's a plus defensive player as well. Now he's got to do his part in the playoffs and play to that kind of level, which he has had a very difficult time of doing. And it's been more of a disappointment than anything else. So when we talk about wasting years is you have a guy like, and you can look at Stanton too. You can, you know, but you know, when you look at Judge being a homegrown Yankee, a guy that was drafted by the Yankees, a guy that came up, you know, without the fanfare of being the Martian and all this stuff, struck out a ton early, made the adjustment, you know, and has become this guy that the rare combination, especially in today's day and age, of being able to hit for average, but be able to drive the ball over the fence. He's been great. And so with the fact he's homegrown and he's been this great and he's in his, you know, mid to early 30s, you want to try and win a championship. Like if Judge's career comes to an end as a Yankee and he doesn't win a World Series, you know, that'd be massively disappointing. You know, if you go back to 2017, if you go back 8 years ago and I ask Yankee fans, well, if you transport yourself 8 years later and go to 2025, do you think that group would win a World Series? You undoubtedly would have said, yes, they haven't. They've been to one. You know, and that's the other aspect of it, too. We could talk about this World Series drought for the Yankees and say, well, they haven't won a World Series since 2009, which is true. They've been to one. Like, it's not like they're dominating the American League either. You know, they haven't. And, you know, I don't want to hear about the cheating scandal with the Houston Astros. You know, I really don't. The Yankees have been more of a disappointment than anything else come playoff time. And that narrative's got to change. So however way you want to couch it, Eric, you know, I think a lot of Yankee fans appreciate Stanton more now than they ever did before. And I think you're seeing the best version of Giancarlo Stanton in the regular season than we've ever seen. He's been remarkable. I mean, it really has, and deserves, you know, all the love and affection as rowdily as you booed him early on in his Yankee tenure at Yankee Stadium. You should cheer him now because he deserves it and deserves all that kind of love. At Cranford, New Jersey, we go. It's Larry. It's the fan. What's going on, Larry?
Oh, hey, Mark. Thanks for having me on your show.
Larry, what's on your mind, buddy?
Well, I want to answer your question before about Anthony Volpe and has he gotten worse? And yet, I think obviously he has. I think the question is it irreversible or not? And I don't think it's irreversible. He just has to get back to doing what made him great, you know, in the minor leagues and in high school and everything, the minors. And I think that's just a level swing. Like, if you look at these players like Tino Martinez and Don Mattingly, they had level swings, and they used to hit tons of home runs. And I don't know why they do this uppercut metrics, and it drives all these players to change their mechanics. I think that screwed him up. It's not irreversible, but he's got to be sent down, and they have to play Caballero the rest of the season. Batting average matters. Caballero doesn't have great batting average either, but I think he's just a different player and more energetic right now. But they have two automatic outs at the bottom of their lineup. They got Volpe and Wells. And you can't have two automatic outs. Batting average matters. People say it doesn't, but it matters. I'm sorry, it matters. So we gotta, you know, get Caballero in there the rest of the year. They'll make the playoffs. See what happens with him. You know, Wells, you're kind of stuck with him. You know, you could put Rice the catcher the rest of the year, but I don't think you can do that right now. But anyway, those are my thoughts. What do you think about
Volpe? Larry, but that's today's day and age of baseball. And, you know, there's going to be guys in the analytics department, they don't stress batting average. They don't. I mean, that's why you're getting, you know, a lot of the conversations about, you know, when Luis Arraez hits free agency with the San Diego Padres, you know, what is his value going to be this upcoming offseason? Because he's a guy, not a great defensive player, but he hits for a good average. And we've seen that over the course of his career. So with Volpe, you want to say that they've changed his swing? It has not been to the positive. His on-base percentage, when you look at Anthony Volpe, is .269. I mean, it's just terrible. And you're not wrong about the automatic outs at the bottom of that lineup. And the level swing, you can go back to guys like Tino Martinez, Don Mattingly. It's a different era of Major League Baseball. That's no longer emphasized. Guys are looking at launch angle. They want to hit the ball over the fence. Strikeouts are not that big of a deal. Players are graded out differently now than they ever were before. Now, that is obviously something to do with the adaptation and the way that bullpens are used, and you're not going to see a starting pitcher third time through the lineup, and the velocity, everything is king, and the max effort, and, you know, that's where we're at. That's what makes McClain so refreshing when you're looking at the New York Mets, is that it's not necessarily based on just pure velocity, throwing the ball 103 miles an hour. You're still going to get that, with some of these guys coming up through the farm system, but that is not him. And the ability to go out there and mix up pitches and throw six different pitches, be competitive in the strike zone, throw 95 pitches last night and throw 71 of them for strikes. That's refreshing. I mean, it really is. When you look at a guy that's not just, well, if he's not hitting the right spot with his velocity, he's going to get hit. And it's more about location than anything else. When you watch McClain work, and what's refreshing is, it's a matter of watching a guy who is, at this stage, pitched really well and is, you know, knows how to pitch. He's not a thrower. Knows how to keep batters off balance. It was brilliant to watch. I mean, that's it. And that's what, and we're looking forward to see what Jonah Tong provides tomorrow night for the New York Mets. So you're not wrong about Volpe. You know, I don't know if they're necessarily going to get to, I mean, the Yankees are in that foxhole with Anthony Volpe. They just are, you know, and I don't know if we're ever going to get to the stage where, you know, they're going to put, I made the statement earlier in the show, bears worth repeating, that if you're looking at just saying, I'm going to roll the best team out there, regardless of the emotional connection, or the fact of what it could do to the player. And maybe they feel like if they did that, they'd lose him completely. I don't know. You know, I don't have that relationship with Anthony Volpe. You know, I'm not managing the New York Yankees. But if you're going to make the argument, well, let's try and roll the best team out there. Can you really make the argument that Anthony Volpe as your starting shortstop is the Yankees' best version that they roll out there on a day-in, day-out basis? And what bothers me sometimes when you look at, and when you listen to Cashman, the Yankees use certain arguments to defend certain players and other arguments to defend others. As a team, when you get to October, it's a roll of the dice. You never know. You build for the regular season and you hope for the best come October. Right? That rationalizes out failure. It just does. Gives you an inherent excuse. When you listen to Volpe, a couple weeks back when Cashman was talking about his starting shortstop, he said, well, clearly what he did last year in October shows you what kind of an impact player he can be. Okay. I get that. And I understand Volpe's penchant for meeting the moment, which I give him a ton of credit for. But do you have any confidence that this version of Anthony Volpe in 2025 will have that kind of an impact come October?
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.